Today is November 9, 2017. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Robert Bob Cornelius, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. And this is a telephone interview. My name is Tom Martin. And Bob, would you mind if we recorded this telephone interview?
No, not at all.
That's great. Thank you. So a couple of days ago, we had talked a little bit about your transitioning from Grand Canyon National Park to Dinosaur National Monument, the connecting link between these two National Park Service units is the Colorado River, which if you start on the river in Grand Canyon and you go upstream enough, you'll go up the Green River arm to Dinosaur National Monument. So we had talked about a number of different things, in particular your job as a river ranger, and you'd mentioned there are 23 boats that the monument had, and we just kind of come up to talk about river accidents and river permits. So,
okay,
how do you want to pick that up?
Well, as far as the number of boats, we had this huge pile of them in a maintenance building at near Dinosaur, Colorado, and most of them were old, what they call bridge pontoons. The actual number of boats that we utilized at any one time was about four or five.
Okay.
And in fact, at one point we bought two, I think they'd been used one season. They were Green River boats, I think they were called. And they were sort of like 10-man. They were probably 12 foot long, 14 foot long.
Okay.
And we got them from Western River, Jack Curry's outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was interesting. The chief ranger called me and said, "We've got money. This was year end money, the way the government works. You know, we've got enough money to buy two new boats. And I've got this contact with Jack Curry. You could give him a call. The problem is, they're in Northwest Colorado. We'd had this huge ice storm, and it had knocked down all the phone lines, and we had no phone service to headquarters for about 2 weeks. And so I had to drive over to Jensen, Utah, and get on a payphone and call the Western River and tell them, okay, the deal's on. You know, we're gonna buy the boats. Here's the number of the purchase order, and if you get them on the way, we'll gladly use them, you know. So that's what that was. Just kind of a weird thing that happened right there. You can see there's maybe a little bit of difference between Grand Canyon and Dinosaur. You know, it was a pretty rural area, and it was almost like the Wild West. I remember going there and talking to Glade Ross. And he was up at Lador, at the northern end of the park. And every year they had a big gathering up there at the Lador schoolhouse. It was like a community center
mm-hmm.
at that time. And people from all over Browns Park would come in there, you know.
Wow.
And probably some of Butch Cassidy's relatives, you know.
Uh-huh.
But the funny thing that Glade said was that he said, "Well, we haven't had a gunfight up there for 7 years." You know? So, and of course, he might have been joking, but it was a pretty tough area up there, you know. You weren't always welcome either. You'd go into a store or something, and you might have a customer. Several times I had customers that said some pretty raunchy things to me.
Because
they
saw your uniform.
Well, they didn't like the National Monument.
Okay.
You know, it took away their hunting. For example, in the monument had a provision where they were doing away with grazing in the park, so people were losing grazing rights as time went on, as the permit changed hands, as the original permittee died.
Yep.
The permit passed, you know, to the to the family, but not if, you know, the blood relatives, but not beyond that. And so slowly the grazing was being phased out. So
mm-hmm.
people were upset about that. And, you know, the same things go on today over, you know, the bear's ears and all these different things.
Uh-huh.
The grand staircase, the reduction in the size of those monuments, there's still local issues going on, you know,
right.
with parks. There
so,
always are. And
so, Bob?
I was just thinking, yeah.
Bob, did anyone say anything about the dam, Echo Park Dam or Split Mountain Dam, or had that been put to bed? I mean,
that
did any of
pretty
the...
much put to bed. You
okay.
Know, it may be occasionally, you know, somebody might say something about it, but I don't recall.
So
at all.
So grazing.
I do remember
grazing
Don,
would have been the deal.
Don,
so,
what was that?
So grazing would have been was the real issue there.
Well, grazing was an issue. The fact that you couldn't hunt up in the park.
Oh, okay, right.
Was an issue. There was also an issue with wild horse roundups on several of them. There was a large horse herd over on, I think it was Diamond Mountain.
Okay.
And there, people, you know, weren't allowed to do that. So there were, you know, that brings up the point of, you know, parks tie up resources.
Okay.
And, you know, my dad and I used to have a conversation every once in a while, and he'd get upset about something and say, well, you can't eat the scenery, he'd say, you know. So,
interesting.
Because he was in construction and stuff, you know.
Ah.
But
how did you respond to that?
Resources.
How did you respond to that?
Huh?
When
well,
you...
I just... well, with my dad, I just, you know, we had a friendly banter about it, you
uh-huh.
know, and then,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't like it was a conversation with great depth or anything.
Okay, all right.
with him, but one of the things I remember Don Hatch talking about was how influential Hatch River Expeditions was in preventing development of Echo Park Dam. And they did that by taking people down the river, you know, by increasing the visitation in an area. Because one of the arguments is always, well, it's a place nobody goes, you know, the place no one knew. That's what they call Glen Canyon.
Uh huh. That's right.
And and the way you develop interest in an area and eventually, you know, a political base is to let people see, hey, we're going to flood this spectacular canyon, what do you think about that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it doesn't affect some people that are interested in water storage, but it does affect the majority of people that think, gee, I don't want to see that underwater.
Can
you know?
Tell me more about Don talking about that, because I've gone through the Echo Park Split Mountain Park Service records from 1949 to 1956, 57, and I just don't see any letters from the Hatch people saying don't do this. I do see them picking up, they get their concession in 1952 or 53, and they start taking the Sierra Club through, but it's way late in the game, and the people that are really carrying the water seem to be the Isaac Walton League and the National Parks Association, who would become the National Parks Conservation Association. I keep hearing these rumors, though, from Hatch that they played a key role, but I can't find it in the record.
Yeah, maybe they didn't write a lot of correspondence and stuff like that. But I think they had influence, according to Don. You know, both locally, and they were probably. I imagine they had opposition locally. But they were a business, and the fact that they were taking, you know, the only way the Isaac Walton League and the Sierra Club and everybody else was going to get down there to see the area was basically to go with somebody that knew how to run the river.
No,
that
right.
Was,
I should clarify. It was doctors and lawyers and garden clubs and people all across the country that didn't see the place by boat, but thought about the national monuments as they thought about national parks and said, we should preserve these places and dams in them. And that seemed to be what really carried the day. It was really fascinating to look at the record.
Sierra Club, I think it was the Sierra Club, put a book out about Dinosaur.
Yep. And, this is Dinosaur.
And that,
yeah.
You know, things like that do, you know, do influence people. And it was, you know, it was the early infancy of the environmental movement was taking place at Dinosaur and then a little later at Glen Canyon. And Glen Canyon, in part, was a trade-off for saving Dinosaur. I mean, that's...
You know,
that's
it's really fascinating. I'm going to jump in here and mention that as well, because what I see in the record is the Upper Basin Water Storage Act had all these dams listed in it, all these projects, and they basically just removed out Echo and Split because Flaming was in there, Flaming Gorge and Navajo Dam and Glen Canyon Dam. It wasn't like we are going to leave this one in and take that one out. It was just like, no, we don't want these dams in the monument, period. And there was no other Park Service lands anywhere else that were going to be impacted by a dam. So that idea that came up later, I think, about this trade-off, there really was no trade-off. Didn't...
Very possible, yeah.
Okay, all right, just...
You know, the Park Service had been stung at Hetch Hetchy years and years ago.
Yes.
You know, it's the early infancy of the Park Service, and you know, I guess the American public doesn't like the, you know, when you can see all the controversy today in Utah, they don't like it when National Park Service lands are used for something other than their intended purpose.
Correct. And
particularly if you flood them, you know.
To really give credit where credit is due, the National Park Service themselves, they were under great restrictions by Department of Interior, but the Park Service really went to bat for Park Service lands within the agency. It was really wonderful to see. So we can't forget to give credit there as well. Anyway, the theme here is just the locals' perception of the monument, and you know, didn't like hunting, or didn't like the fact that you couldn't hunt, didn't like the grazing and the slow retirement of the grazing permits, and a little bit about the dam. Did you see that then, a little or a lot, sort of this hesitancy or reluctance or downright dislike of the monument?
Well, there have been some movements over the years to redesignate Dinosaur as a national park, and the local people just don't want it up there.
Okay.
They're afraid that there's going to be more restrictions if it's a national park, which isn't the case. A national monument has as much protection as a national park as far as legislatively, ordinarily, unless there's something in the legislation that would make it different, you know. Like, for example, a place like Curacanti, you can hunt. You can hunt under state law.
Okay.
And, Dinosaur itself, they, in order to get it to be a national monument, they had to allow grazing. And I forget what the percentage of the park was that was grazed, but it was way over 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and cattle certainly have an influence on the environment,
you know,
both in some cases positive, some cases, in most cases negative, you know, and so when there's also sheep too, you don't want to leave them out. The grazing in general involved both cattle and sheep up there at Dinosaur.
Okay.
The Mantle Ranch, I think even to this day is still I guess you could say a thorn in the side of the Park Service. You know, the Tim Mantle and his ranch down there. We had issues with them, basically all the time overgrazing. Their grazing allotments, the number of cattle they could run on the allotments. He didn't allow access. They did at one point. They allowed boaters to go in there, and this guy Ray Harrington, who was my mentor, I guess, maintenance man that taught me how to run the rivers the first summer, his son Mike went down there, and I think it was LaRue the wife of Tim, got a gun out and shot his raft.
Wow.
And because they'd left the gate open or something. And we had a couple of cases where they shot at river runners going by because they disturbed their peacocks in one case. It was it was the Wild West, you know. So I had to call the sheriff a couple times and at least, you know, report this. I don't know if anything was ever done about some of it. The river runners themselves didn't want to do anything because they were afraid things would get, you know, would get worse if anything. But there were a lot of issues with that family down there, you know, and the park wanted it for a, you know, a put on place and also a camping area for the river runners.
Okay.
You've got a nice flat area there. You also got the Mantle Cave, which is an archaeological place there that's in the park, but that was always seemed to be in dispute. You know, there was always a dispute as to where the boundary was when they did the original, as I recall, did the original description.
Hmm.
It looked like the surveyor made a mistake, and the Mantles ended up with a bunch of rocks on the north side of the river rather than the bottom lands that they
on the south
wanted.
Side.
There
Oops.
There was always a dispute as to where the Mantle cabin was. It was partly within the park, they thought, or within the monument.
Huh.
And you know, I guess, you know, my dad used to always say, if you want to start an argument, hire a surveyor. You know. That's what happens. But there were a lot of issues. I had one time where the Ted Hatch went up into he talked about going up into Mather Hole, which is upstream from Castle Park, and that was where our campground was, and there were, whenever you'd go in there to camp, there were cow flops everywhere. I mean, the whole campground would be covered in them, because Mantles would run their cattle up there in the winter. That was their winter bull pasture, was Mather Hole. And in one case, I guess a cow came down in there, and Ted Hatch, I was told, hit it in the head with a 2x4 or something, you know, and killed this cow. But later on, now there was a calf that a few weeks later, these guys for Partners River Group came in there, and they took this calf and they put it on their raft, and they took it all the way to Split Mountain. And how they did it, I have no idea. But anyway, I called Tim Mantle, and I said, I told him what had happened, and he was enraged. You know, what are they doing taking my cow? And I said, look, Tim, I said, they're just a bunch of stupid kids, you know, and they thought the calf was in distress, and they're just helping you out. And the cow's over in Jensen, Utah, if you want to go pick it up, you know.
Huh.
But I don't know if Ted actually killed the cow or just chased it away, but anyway,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, rumors over the years can get kind of inflated.
yeah. And who were the Partners? Was that just the name of the trip leader, or was that a commercial group?
Well, there were a bunch. You know, Partners Group was Partners is a organization that takes kids that are referred by the courts or don't have you know, maybe the don't have parents, and they mentor these kids. They take a partner, an adult partner, and they and they match them up with a kid, and then the it's just a way of having an adult, a responsible adult with a kid that's having troubles.
Nice.
Basically.
Okay.
But I'm trying to remember. We had two groups. Tour West. They were out of Orem, Utah, and Partners, and they had a lot of user days, but they were considered to be private groups. And at the beginning of the season, when you'd have your lottery, they would flood the office with all kinds of permits. And because they had these, because they had all these user days, because they had been operating at that level when the restrictions were put in place, it was huge. But the concessioners didn't like them because they were really running commercial trips, and eventually it caught up to them. What they would do is they would run paying passengers down, and then they would take the money from those paying passengers, and part of it would go for a couple of trips for the youth. And you know, we didn't realize that was going on for a long time, and I think it was after I left that they finally realized that, you know, Partners was really running a kind of a hybrid commercial operation, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
And the same way with Tour West. Tour West had a really weird deal where they had paddlers. They had a hybrid boat where they'd have the paddlers, then they had one guy with oars, and they were really running a commercial outfit, although everybody was, you know, a family member when they'd go down the river. There were quite a few things like that that were going on, and it was a lot of times hard to prove, you know. That,
yeah.
That
someone
was really without getting into financial records and everything else.
So Bob, let me make sure I understand this right, because the concessioners, Hatch and Western, had their user days, and then there was user days for the general public. And it sounds like Partners and Tour West had lots of user days that they were pulling out of the public pile. Is that right?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's correct, there for a while, until at least after I left, you know. But you have to realize, too, that the river operation, you know, as far as having a river ranger, was only a few years old at that point. So we were just kind of, you know, getting our toes wet as far as, you know, management of the river. And although they, you know, been doing it for years, you know, letting people go down, they hadn't tried to control it. And I'm trying to think. There were, you know, you had Hatch, you had Western. Those were the two big commercial operations. Then there was another one. A guy named Keith Counts, Adventure Bound, and they were out of Craig, Colorado.
Okay.
And those were the three, I think those were the three big ones that we had. And then we had a few others. I remember we had other commercial outfits trying to operate in the park. Dvorak over in up there in the Arkansas River. I remember he wanted to start running commercially, and it was just too late in the game at that point.
Okay.
There weren't enough user days. So, and I don't remember what the split was at Dinosaur. I think it was a lot fairer at Dinosaur than it was at Grand Canyon. You had a much higher percentage of private users at Dinosaur.
You know, it's funny because Dino had concessions, but then you couldn't get a permit unless you brought a guide for a while in the 50s into the 60s. And then, you know, you had the whole Partner TW deal where the do-it-yourself pile was being gobbled up by these quasi-commercial kind of groups. And so it might have looked like, on paper, it might have looked good, but in actuality, it wasn't.
Well, yeah, I guess, looking at it that way, that's true. I guess. I
Yeah,
don't know.
yeah, yeah,
Been
yeah.
so
I had to
many years, you know, that was
get
a
into
long time
the
ago,
details
Tom.
of it all. Sure, yeah. So
Yeah.
were there any accidents on the river at all? Did things go okay
You know, there
there?
weren't a lot. I remember the Hatch River wrapped a boat around Despain Rock down in the Split Mountain Gorge one time, and they rescued themselves. You know, they went down, took some other rafts down, and threw ropes to the guys. But I think the passengers ended up having to jump in the river, you know, to get and then get pulled out. And Don, I remember Don Hatch telling me, he said, "You wouldn't believe all the stuff the people claimed that they had on board of the boats, you know,
Oh.
when they after the accidents, you know, because of insurance, you know."
Okay.
And we had they had a place up at Triplet Falls called Sheraw Rock, and Wally Sheraw, who was an astronaut, was his boat tipped over there at Triplet, and they lost, you know, they were doing a documentary, and they lost thousands and thousands of dollars in camera equipment. That happened before I got there.
Okay.
And we had one incident I recall where a hatch boat went into a cliff at below Disaster Falls. They got too far to the right, and a passenger had his leg over the tube,
Ooh.
and he broke his leg and got it all lacerated up. And I remember that incident because wait just one second. Oh, are you taking off? Okay, all right. Okay, Martha had to drop the dog off. Dog was upset.
Oh no.
I'm in the bedroom. So anyway, I went over to Vernal one time, and the hatch where their house was, you went down some stairs into the basement, and that's where the office was down the stairs. It was the whole basement was a big office, and I walked down there because I was gonna. I did an interview just like we're doing with Don Hatch when
Okay.
I was at Dinosaur,
Ah.
and we talked about a whole bunch of things. And the morning I did that, I went down to look for him, and I went into the basement, and there was this great big guy. I mean, I'm 6'3". He was like, you know, 7 foot tall and about 4 foot wide. This guy was huge.
Okay.
And when Don finally came upstairs, I said, "Who was that guy down there?" And he said he was a U.S. Marshal. He was serving us with papers about, I think it was this incident where the guy broke his leg. And you know, the court papers where they had to go to court and prove that they weren't at fault in this particular accident.
Huh.
And it's, you know, we had a drowning. The I got there in, I believe it was May of 73, and just a couple weeks prior there had been a drowning at Schoolboy Rapid, which is in Split Mountain Gorge. And Schoolboy, there's a whole bunch of rollers, and they go down and end in this cliff, and the whole river kind of piles up on this cliff and then roars around to the right around this cliff. And it's fairly easy to run, you know, it's fun, there's all these big rollers, and then you get off to the right. Well, somehow the boat got up onto this where the river piled up and flipped, and a woman got trapped underneath an overhanging cliff below the main rapid there, and got hung up with her life jacket. And another interesting thing, when I first got to Dinosaur, they still had some of these old blue navy life jackets. You know, the Park Service would get all kinds of surplus junk, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember we had this maintenance man there, and he said that they had gone down the river through Lador, and there's the first rapid was one we call Little Stinker, and it's just a big rock in the middle of the river, and they'd wrapped this 28-foot pontoon boat or whatever around this rock.
This
And
was
he said he got up
an
on
NPS trip.
this was an
Okay.
They used to have like family trips. They would take everybody from the park, and they'd get on the raft, and they'd go down the river.
Oh, that's cool.
And they would use that as a way of letting the families know, what are their husbands doing,
mm-hmm.
and wives doing, and why does it take them so long, and why do they come back so dirty, and et cetera, et cetera. And so they would do this, and so this was one of those trips, and he said he got up on this rock, and he was going to jump. He jumped off into the river, and he said he went right to the bottom with this old
life jacket. Oh, my gosh.
Because it was just a piece of junk, you know. And they did these family trips until one day they were coming out of Split Mountain Gorge, apparently. Now, this is just what I've heard. I wasn't there at that time because we could not take families or any friends or anything on the river. And there's a big kind of a ledge that's undercut about, oh, I don't know, maybe a quarter or half mile up river from Split Mountain Gorge. And it's not hard to avoid, but somehow they got underneath that thing and got a couple of people hurt. And so after that, they stopped doing any kind of family, you know, non-employee type trips, you know.
Okay.
You couldn't take anybody. So that era was over. And the same thing happened in a lot of other parks, too, at some point. Liability got to the point where they no longer wanted to let family members. Because I took my mom and dad on Lake Powell, took them up to Rainbow Bridge. I did the same at Kirk Haney, and then at some point in the 80s or something like that, there was a dictate that came down, and we couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Huh.
So, bummer.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Huh.
But,
So that fatality in Schoolboy, the woman who drowned, was that on a hatch trip?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember what... because I wasn't there at the time, but I know it was a commercial. Pretty sure it was a commercial trip. And then it seemed like there was another drowning at Dinosaur after I left, but I don't remember any details.
And
but overall, there weren't. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you about Jack. Jack Curry. Did you get a chance to interview him, or do you have any stories about Jack?
No, I. With him, I talked to him on the phone a number of times, but I, just business type stuff, you know, changing campsites and this and that. I remember meeting him at Grand Canyon at Phantom a couple of times, you know, just in passing, basically.
Okay. But, you know, you mentioned that Ted Hatch was sort of larger than life. Was Jack that way as well?
I think so. I think he was, but just the impression I have, but I don't remember that much about him.
Hmm.
Well, I met Georgie White too. You know,
okay.
She would come in there to Phantom on her. She had this triple rig or something that she she ran. You know, and her skin was just like a paper bag. I mean, it was just unbelievable. You know, she had this tan, you know, that just glowed, you know, and looked pretty crinkly. I guess there was always rumor that she was somebody else. She wasn't Georgie White, really wasn't Georgie White, that she was
Bessie Hyde.
Bessie Hyde, yeah. I don't
yeah.
know if there's any truth to that or not, but it makes for an interesting story.
It does. It does.
Oh,
huh. So that's sort of accidents, and you were saying, I interrupted, you were saying it sounded like there weren't a lot of accidents up there.
Well, there's a lot of self-rescue.
Okay.
You know, you don't have the ability, and you've got one boat on the river, and if you're below the accident scene, you might be able to help, you know, pull people out. We did that. I did that a bunch of times. In fact, we got half our oars from going along the river and picking up oars and repainting them, you know. But the Warm Springs Rapid ate a lot of boats, I mean, it's amazing. I was there one time on a, we took a, it was kind of a river symposium, and we had people from the Bureau of Reclamation, Canyonlands National Park, Grand Canyon. They all got together, and they had a big symposium, we called it. And, well, actually, there were two of them, I remember. One of them, Glade, got the title of being the wild man of dinosaur because he didn't like all of the new regulations and the, you know, what Glade liked to do was get on his boat. He had this little boat called Stubby, and he'd take Stubby down and go and he'd fish. And he loved to trout fish and stuff and you know, just take a week and leisurely go down the river. Well, that, you know, he couldn't get permits and stuff for that anymore, or he was battling to get permits, and things were just a little bit too organized for him, and he got a little bit drunk at Harding Hole, I remember, and told all of the big shots what he thought of them, you know. So he was the wild man at dinosaur after that. But we had this other trip that Hatch River Expeditions put on for us, and they didn't put it on for us. They were contracted to go down, so we had a big pontoon boat, and we had a little Hypalon raft, and I forget how many people were on the trip, but probably a dozen, you know, or so, different regional directors and all these things. We got down to Warm Springs Rapid, and I had been in both boats off and on, and I got in this little Hypalon with this kid, and the first day when we were going from Deer Lodge downstream, and I could tell that he, you know, didn't have a lot of experience, but he, you know, he was doing a pretty good job running the river, but he'd never run Warm Springs by himself. I got that out of him. So I was a little concerned. And when we got to Warm Springs Rapid, I was in the big boat by this time, and the boat pilot said, would all of you mind walking around the rapid, because this is a big boat, and I want to be able to run it without all the weight of the passengers in there.
Uh-huh.
And the river was it was really in flood. We were going down river, and there were dead cows and huge logs going down, so there was a lot of water going through Warm Springs. So I got out. I thought, yeah, might as well, you know, I don't want to tip over. Because there had been a hatch boatman killed, the first guy that went through Warm Springs after it was it developed in the 60s, drowned, and he was a hatch boatman, and so it had a bad obviously a bad reputation. But this little Hypalon raft, they decided that they could run it through with this kid, and a couple of Park Service guys decided they wanted to go along with him. And I remember one of the guys said, here, would you take my camera and take some pictures of it? And he had a little Kodak kind of box camera. And I said, sure. So I'm looking through the lens as they're coming down. There's a little point right above the big hole.
Uh-huh.
And I was standing on that point. And here comes this raft down the river. And I thought, this kid's in the wrong place. When you run Warm Springs, you're supposed to stay to the right and kind of hug the shore.
Uh-huh.
If you get out on those big rollers, they're so powerful that you can't get out of them to get away from this big hole.
Right.
That we used to call the Maytag. And so I'm watching this kid, so I thought, boy, they're going to eat it, you know. And so I put down this guy's camera, and I got my 35-millimeter camera, and I started taking pictures of this boat as it goes into this hole, and it just flips right over, and all these guys are in the river now, and there's boxes. I had pictures of down, and you know, a head would pop up, and it was, you know, it was ugly. We had a couple guys got hit on the head with boxes, and we had to do some first aid and stuff.
Oh my
and
gosh!
Of course, we had to chase all the gear down and everything. But that happened a lot at Warm Springs. If someone chose not to portage and to run the rapid, because it was pretty serious stuff.
Wow, yeah, huh?
In fact, I mentioned taking the powerboat up there.
Yeah, all the way up to the foot of Warm Springs.
And that was what I did it. One reason I did it was to just watch people come through the rapids and see how they did. And I saw several portaging, and I didn't see anybody tip over at all.
Okay.
You know?
So, all right.
That was a good thing.
Good, yeah. And then you mentioned permits, and we were kind of talking a little bit before we started to turn the machine on here about increased visitation happening at Grand Canyon and the Park Service needing to put in a lottery to distribute permits when they cut back the number of people that could camp at the Phantom Ranch campground there, Bright Angel campground.
Right.
And you'd mentioned some in the last interview about spending a lot of time on the phone just sorting out permits for Dinosaur. And
right.
So could you talk a little bit about the permits and how that system worked or didn't work at times?
Well, of course, with Grand Canyon, you know, they had these huge numbers of people showed up down at Phantom Ranch. Originally, we had they would issue the permits up at the South Rim District Ranger Office. That was one of my duties, and it was really crazy during the spring, during the Easter, what we called Easter period, and you would spend the entire day standing at the desk, basically issuing permits. You'd have a line, you know, going out the door of the ranger station there. We had one kid, I remember. we were working, myself and another guy were working midnight to 8 shifts, and being dispatcher, and so we were just dying to get another seasonal to help with the workload.
Yeah.
And this one guy got hired. He came out, and the district ranger was there, and the kid came into the lobby, and he says, you know, hi, I'm your new seasonal ranger, and the guy said, well, the district ranger said, well, go sit over there in that chair over there, and I'll get to you in just a couple of minutes. And the kid sat in the lobby, I guess, and watched this influx of people coming in and getting permits, just one right after another, and the person that was manning the desk and giving out the permits noticed that this guy got stood up and walked out the door, walked over into the old Babbitt's parking lot, and that's the last he saw of him. He never said goodbye or anything. He just refused to stay there, and I think the district ranger got a postcard from him from San Diego about a week later.
Oh my
gosh.
So
it was kind of intimidating, you know, to have this many people come in. I remember, you know, Harvey Butchert coming in there getting a permit, and I'm asking him all these questions, you know, when I first time I met him, asking him all these questions about his experience and everything, and one of the rangers, the permanent ranger, stepped out of the back room and said, give him the permit, you know.
Oh, so this wasn't
so
this
let
wasn't
him do whatever he wants to do.
This wasn't river permits. This was backcountry hiking permits.
These were hiking permits.
Got it.
As far as river permits, we had nothing to do. I had nothing to do with them.
Got it.
You know, they were issued by, you know, I'm not absolutely sure how they issued them. I guess over at the visitor center, they had where they had the administration building. They handled them over there.
Okay.
At that time.
Okay.
But later on, then they within probably a few years, the influx of people wanting backcountry hiking permits and camping permits really skyrocketed, and they ended up, you know, building up and having a backcountry office where that's all they did and that's all they do today is issue permits, you know,
right.
One right after another.
Yeah.
And
So
know, it's
thinking
almost
about.
insane to think of, and from my perspective, you know, that it's gotten that crazy where people are so excited to get a permit that they can just hardly contain themselves.
Yeah, well, they're getting very, very competitive to get. So thinking about Dinosaur, it sounds like at Grand Canyon you were helping in the distribution of permits for backcountry backpacking, but at Dinosaur you were in the office working on river permits.
River permits. We didn't have hardly any backcountry use at Dinosaur.
Oh, interesting.
Hardly any at all. It was all the way people saw the backcountry at Dinosaur is there were a couple of backcountry roads that they drove, but very little camping in the backcountry except on the river. That's how people saw the backcountry at Dinosaur at that time.
Okay.
was on the river. And I know one thing I did. I used to work on my river boats during the winter. I'd go over and I'd paint them and I'd build new frames for the boats if I wanted to do that, or build boxes, or you know, all kinds of stuff. There's always something to do over there. And and then in the summer you'd want to go on the river. Well, the way the permits were set up, they were issuing the permits in the spring, and of course that's when everybody wants to go, so it was really chaotic where you're issuing permits right before someone's ready to go. And so I told the chief ranger, I said, let's take and issue the permits in the winter, because that's when I have all my time. I'm working on river boats. I'm not, you know, if I'm doing it in the spring and summer, I can't go on the river, and I can't be part of the river operation. And so he said, okay. So we set, a date of January 15th.
Okay.
And that's when we were going to start accepting permits for the next season. And we advertised in all the local and regional newspapers and that sort of thing as best we could to let people know that we were no longer taking the or starting to issue permits like the 1st of May or 1st of April.
Mm-hmm.
But we were now doing it in January. And so that initially created some problems because people that had been doing it for years weren't reading the newspaper, and I mentioned, you know, the Uinta County sheriff, former Governor Vanderhoof, and I'm sure there were a lot of other people that had gotten permits in the past and, you know, routinely got them, and they were very upset. So So we had those growing pains, but we had a waiting list. We made a waiting list, you know, and people would call us and they'd say, well, I've only got 6 people instead of 10 people on my trip. So that frees up user days, you know, or someone would cancel a trip or change the dates of the trip. So that frees up a campsite.
So this was 1972 or 3?
Yeah, this was 73, 74, that period of time.
Okay.
I moved to Dinosaur in May of 73, and I left in August of 75.
Okay.
And I left reluctantly, too. I didn't, I was a park technician, what I was called. That was my title. And I got an opportunity to become a full-fledged park ranger by going through intake program at Glen Canyon, and that's really why I left Dinosaur. I remember I had a conversation with the superintendent. I was up mowing my lawn or something, and he drove up into the residential area, and he said, would you like to go to Glen Canyon? And I said, well, what do you mean? And so he explained it, and I said, well, I'll stay here if you give me a higher graded job.
Uh-huh.
And he said, and he just laughed, you know. And the guy that replaced me was pretty black and white, as I understand it, and you know, really wasn't a real people person.
they missed the boat when they let you go.
They had issues.
Yeah.
What's that?
They missed the boat when they let you go. That was a bad deal.
They did, yeah, I think so.
Yep. So you'd mentioned a story that I was like, wait a minute. It sounded like as you guys implemented this permit change from the spring to the winter to January 15th, that, as you mentioned, there were some people that got kind of left out. Do you got any stories about that and what happened?
Well, the one with the Uinta County Sheriff we mentioned earlier, or excuse me, Moffat County Sheriff.
I think we turned the machine off by then.
their annual trip, and they couldn't do it, you know. And so I said, but this was the county sheriff we were dealing with, who has authority for search and rescue and law enforcement and everything in the park.
Ah.
So you really can't tell that person that they can't go down. And so they ended up, you know, they did end up going down the river. We did have issues with them, though, in that we got a bunch of complaints about their behavior and the drunkenness and having guns and all kinds of stuff in the campsites. And so I called the sheriff and talked to him, and he said, well, that won't happen anymore. And the next year they got a permit, and everybody went with their wives, so that kind of toned down the bad behaviors
uh-huh.
that they'd have.
Nice.
But we had you know, in the park we had very little, as we talked about, you know, I talked about arresting this group of guys that had a river permit or didn't have a river permit at Dinosaur. And I was trying to make the point that I'd had a conversation. I was in a conversation with Don Hatch about them not having life jackets, and he was feeling very picked on. And then this was an opportunity for me to say, "Look, we're actually being pretty fair, because we arrested these guys that didn't have permits." And the problem that we had at Dinosaur is that and the same thing at Glen Canyon is you have a state line that runs through the middle of the park.
Ah.
So you have Colorado law, Utah law, and federal law. And the jurisdiction is what's called concurrent jurisdiction, where we each had, or proprietary jurisdiction in some cases, where you don't have full authority as a federal law enforcement officer. You share the law enforcement authority with the state and county people.
Okay.
And so in all the parks I've worked in, I was deputized in the counties. I was a deputy in Coconino County and in Gunnison County and Montrose County and Moffat County and Uinta County. So all these different jurisdictions that you had. And the reason we did that in part was that particularly in Utah, the judicial system was, I guess you'd say it was broken. They didn't have any. In Utah in particular, there was one federal judge. His name was Wallace Ritter, and he was in Salt Lake City, and he had one other magistrate, and that was it for the entire state of Utah.
Wow.
Federal law. If you wanted to have someone appear before a federal judge, they would have to go to Utah. And Judge Ritter was extraordinarily unpredictable. And I only had one case that I sent to him, and that was when I was at Glen Canyon. And the way that what happened there, we would handle everything. The point is, we handle everything with state law. At Dinosaur, we did the same thing. They had state laws that you had to have a boating permit and that you had to have life jackets and these things. And we would use the justice of the peace at Dinosaur or one over in Vernal.
Okay.
And we didn't use federal judges at all, federal. So all the other regulations were just done by, you know, verbal warnings and written warnings and those types of things. It was all kind of show. And but the one case I had before, or had with Judge Ritter, I was at Rainbow Bridge, and I was working the marina, and these two guys were a little bit drunk, and they got into the patrol boat, and they started using the PA system and yelling all kinds of things, obscenities and everything else around the bay where the Rainbow Marina was. It was back up in Forbidden Canyon there. And so I got these guys out of the boat, and I took them in my office, and I wrote them two federal citations for basically tampering with government equipment. And they were on a houseboat, and I remember the guy who was the sort of the leader of the group with the houseboat, he came down to my office after this had all occurred, and he absolutely begged me to not send this ticket through on these guys. He said, do you know that they'll have to appear before Judge Ritter in Salt Lake City? And I said, I know. I said, that's not my problem. I said, they shouldn't have gotten in that boat. And so what we had to do with that citation is you had to send it down to your district ranger, and then the district ranger took it to the chief ranger. Then the chief ranger got in consultation with the U.S. attorney in Salt Lake, and then the U.S. attorney would decide whether or not to go forward with the case. And in this case, the U.S. attorney called me, and when I was down at Waheap, and he really talked to me a long time about the case, and he was concerned because of the unpredictability of Judge Ritter. And he said, last week, he said some guys came in and they had stolen some Christmas trees out of the Ashley National Forest. He said they had a pickup truck and they had a bunch of Christmas trees in them. They were caught by a forest ranger and they were given a citation. They went before Judge Ritter, and he said he gave them 20 years.
Wow.
And he said that, yeah, that's what the U.S. attorney said. He said, we had to go and talk to Judge Ritter, and then a day or two later, he came back and reversed himself and gave them, like, time served or something like that. And so he was very unpredictable.
Wow.
They went ahead with this case of mine. And, I never found out, never really tried to find out what happened to these guys. But the fact is, they did show up in court.
Okay.
And they did have to go before this federal judge. And if nothing else, they were absolutely scared to death.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Huh.
But we had to handle everything through state court there at Glen Canyon when I was there. And it was just, it didn't work very well. And later on, we did. Finally, in the Arizona side, we started using the federal court down in Phoenix and had pretty good success with that. Dinosaur, we had a guy at Dinosaur named N.E. Martin, and he held court at Dinosaur, Colorado, and he was a real old guy. He was like 90 years old, but he was still very sharp. And we would call down and would say, Judge Martin, we've got this guy here, and he wasn't wearing a life jacket at Echo Park, and could you see the case? Sure, come on down. And we'd go down to his house, or he had a little courtroom down in Dinosaur, and he couldn't see very good, and so we had this one fish and game statutes, and he would always say, bring the big book. And so we'd take this book down that had big letters in it, and then we figured out pretty quickly, myself and a couple of other rangers, that Judge Martin really liked park rangers, and if you brought somebody down there to his court, they were guilty. It did not matter the circumstances. And so we had to be really careful. You know, we had to be absolutely sure that this person deserved some kind of penalty. And, of course, usually it was a fine. And And the reason, one of the reasons that we took anybody into custody at all, or tried to, I mean, it was almost a joke. Like I said the other day, the guys without the permit over in at Split Mountain had to follow us to the courtroom in their own car. And, you know, they weren't really arrested. We didn't put any handcuffs on them or anything. We just
if they had driven away, would you have given chase?
We didn't have marked vehicles, really. I mean, it was crazy, absolutely insane. And that's how you know, the Park Service really was in its infancy as far as law enforcement, providing the law enforcement tools and the skills and the training. We didn't have any equipment to, you can't put a, you know, you couldn't put the guys in the bed of the pickup truck and drive them down there. You know?
Right, right.
We had another one on the Colorado side where some guys poached a deer up on Blue Mountain there. We caught them. We took the deer, we threw it in our pickup truck, and said, follow us down to Judge Martin's office. We went down there. Judge Martin fined them, I forget how, a couple hundred dollars or something. They didn't have any money, so we took them back over to the park headquarters, and I got in consultation with the chief ranger and the superintendent and everything. We're all pulling our hair out. What are we going to do with these guys? They don't have any money. We don't have a way to transport them to the Moffat County Jail. We're going to have to call the sheriff to come get them. And then finally, I came up with this idea. I said, let's take their car. They had had like a 1970-something Mustang.
Wow.
I said, let's take their car as collateral. And then if they agreed, they'd have some friends come pick them up, and then in a week they would come back with the money to pay the fine, and then we'd let them have their car back. It was, and you know, it worked. You had to be a little creative at times, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, I grew up in the Park Service, sort of in a transitional period as far as law enforcement goes. You know, I started in 1969, and then in 1970, they had the Yosemite riots.
Okay.
And that basically changed everything as far as management realizing, hey, we have a problem. We have a lot of law enforcement issues occurring in the parks, but we don't have people that are professionally trained to deal with these, and even then they don't have the equipment to deal with it either. And so that happened, and then in 1972 or 3, Ken Patrick was shot and killed at Point Reyes National Seashore.
Yes.
And you know, as a guy who you know, originally wanted to be an interpreter in the parks, and then found out rangers had all the fun and started doing that, these were kind of scary, became scary times.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, here at that time they thought, well, he was the first park ranger ever killed, and as they started going back in the records, they realized there had been almost a half dozen rangers that had been shot and killed in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken Patrick's case, even at that point in 73, I think it was, part of the reason they think that he was shot was that he couldn't get to his firearm. And that was because of the coat he was wearing. And we all wore these coats. I had one, just a big parka, like a North Face parka. And there was no zipper or way, unless you pulled the coat way up and put it over the top of your pistol,
yeah,
you couldn't get to your pistol. And that was part of the reason his wife Tommy at Glen Canyon. She went on to be a park ranger. I think she was the chief ranger at Glen Canyon, and she even went on to the superintendency up in one of the parks in Alaska and stuff. And
okay.
She was a very competent person. We never talked. I never talked to her about the incident. You know, I know it was a terrible, terrible situation for her. But she was a very good ranger, and but we had the Ken Patrick thing, and then there was about that same time. I remember there was an incident at Mesa Verde where they said the guy that reported it said somebody stepped out from behind a tree and blasted a shotgun at his car, and that was always kind of questionable, but the fact was it sort of added to this fervor that, you know, wow, this is getting to be kind of a serious job, you know.
Yeah.
And even Canyon de Chelly, you know, you think of Canyon de Chelly as being a little out of the way park. That was one of the challenges the Park Service faced, is how do you provide law enforcement at all these little monuments in Arizona and other places, you know, that are way out in the Bojacks, you know, your natural bridges and,
right.
and Hovind Weep and all these places. Canyon de Chelly, 2 weeks ago they had a shooting there.
That's
where
right.
a ranger shot a Navajo man that had a knife, but there's not a lot of information on that. But there was an earlier incident at Canyon de Chelly, and this occurred in the 1980s, as I recall. And it was really crazy. Canyon de Chelly is an odd place in that you have a paved road that goes along the rim, and right adjacent to that paved rim is the Navajo Indian Reservation, and you have sort of two worlds there. You got a lot of poor people. Very poor people out on the reservation, and you've got all these rich tourists that drive in their cars.
Right.
And so you have a lot of car clout, people breaking into cars and stealing things, bothering the tourists, so to speak, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had this one incident where this guy, they caught him breaking into a car out on one of the viewpoints, and the chief ranger went out there. I don't know if he had any help or not, and he had a shotgun. And at that time, you know, the Park Service they wanted to do law enforcement. They wanted to be law enforcement officers, but they didn't always want to really do the job. You know what I mean? And so we had to use number 4 buckshot in our shotguns.
Okay.
And number 4 buckshot is birdshot.
Right.
So they wanted to kind of make somebody angry by shooting them, but not put them down. And this guy, as I recall, the chief ranger, during the confrontation, shot him with the shotgun. And it sort of just made the guy mad. And then the gun jammed, the shotgun jammed, and they got into a physical altercation of the viewpoint, and they both fell over the cliff, and the ranger landed on a ledge, and the Navajo man bounced and went right down to the bottom of the canyon and was killed. So, you know, had the shotgun had the proper, you know, had better ammunition in it and not jammed. And I heard that later on by someone who knew a little bit more that maybe they had a shotgun there that was supposed to be repaired and wasn't, you know, but who knows.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's frightening when you're in law enforcement and you think, you know, here's this little podunk park out there in the middle of northern Arizona, and people are getting in armed confrontations with rangers. It really is kind of insane. And you know, my idea growing up was you went to the parks and you had a wonderful time, and you went on nature walks, and you sat around the campfire, and you just had a wonderful time, and there was never any thought of criminal activity. You know, it's like it was an island in the middle of the country, but that's not a realistic view of the national parks, and certainly isn't today.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
yeah.
But the jurisdictional issues at some of these parks were really a problem, because you had to kind of massage the state laws so you could apply them toward the management of the park, so to speak. You know.
Yeah.
The life jackets and the permits and those types of things. And,
right.
And
of course, state law and federal law.
So it made
law
for
and,
a really interesting, interesting thing.
Yeah, yeah. What other comparisons or contrasts did you see between the much larger visited Grand Canyon National Park and the much smaller visited Dinosaur National Monument? Oh, it was still a large park with a lot of acreage, not as big as Grand Canyon, but still fairly big.
Yes, well, one of the things at that time is the number of foreign tourists. Grand Canyon was just overwhelmed with Japanese, Germans, other Europeans, lots of foreign tourists, and
okay.
I think that probably extended to some of the other parks in the local area, Zion and
the Grand Circle parks, sure.
Yeah, but maybe the Grand Circle parks. Dinosaur didn't quite attract that many people, and as far as foreign tourists. So that was one thing that was different up there. We didn't have the parking. The parking problems that they have at a Grand Canyon, because our visitation was a lot, so much smaller,
right,
than there. We didn't have a concession in the park as far as grocery store. We didn't have a post office. We didn't have a town in the park. Your town was towns in the case of Dinosaur were adjacent to the park: Vernal, Utah; Dinosaur, Colorado; Craig, Colorado;
good point,
Maybell.
Yep.
And so a lot different. So you're not dealing with concession employees. And when it gets to the law enforcement aspect, a lot of the problems, the majority of the problems, were not from tourists that came in from out of the park. They were from the concession employees and park employees that lived in the park.
Okay.
You've got a permanent residence at Grand Canyon. I think Grand Canyon Village in the summer was 1,500 to 2,000 people.
And now
permanent
it's
residents.
Now it's up to 3,000. Yeah, yeah. So it's
yeah, and you've got all of the problems that we have in any town. You've got the everyone from the town drunk to somebody burglarizing their neighbor,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all there, and we dealt with these concessions all the time, and we didn't have in the early 70s, you didn't have the ability to, like, do a quick background check on somebody, check their criminal record. What we had to do is we had to fingerprint people, send the fingerprints to the FBI. The FBI would then send back a criminal report, and that's one thing that Lloyd Hohner dealt with a lot. And we would fingerprint everybody that got a job at Grand Canyon. And what they would do, they'd go to the Fred Harvey General offices, which were across the street from the superintendent's house in the Altamar Hotel, and they would walk. They might walk or drive down to the ranger station. They'd give them a card, say, "Here, go get this card filled out, bring it back, and get it signed." And we'd keep the fingerprints, but I mean, Fred Harvey had its own internal system there of how they knew that they'd come down to the South Rim District Ranger office And there were a number of them that never went back to the Fred Harvey offices because they knew that they were going to get found out that they were,
I
know,
see.
There was some
yeah.
kind of criminal behavior
and
in their background.
So Dinosaur,
and
would you, I mean, it's very different because clearly it's not a town there, but when you had to try to identify someone, how did you do that? I mean, would you get their fingerprints and then send that out to the FBI? That you can't just like wait.
Well, we didn't have any. We didn't have a local population other than our park employees.
Okay.
There were no concession employees in the park.
Got it.
Other than those that came through the park with the river trips and stuff like that, and we didn't do any background checks on those people at all. That was up to the company.
Right.
To do that.
But I was just thinking if a tourist...
It'd certainly be something good to do, you know, because you want to have a good quality people that are going
right.
With tourists down the rivers, but we didn't at that time have any way to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about a...
And really, Grand Canyon didn't, you know, we would get reports back from the FBI weeks or months after, and there were some bad people up there. I mean,
wow.
There really were some really bad people. And we didn't have this, you know, this NCIC system or anything where you could check license plates or anything. I mean, it
right.
was just all pretty much internal. We could call down to the sheriff's office in Williams or Flagstaff and get local records, but you couldn't do much else than that, you know.
Okay.
So, you know, what's kind of crazy, too, one of the crazy things I always found out, I always felt, is that here you've got a person you call is a park ranger and he's a law enforcement person, but the Park Service was so worried about its image, they really didn't want rangers carrying guns. That was not something they wanted them to do, and yet you had campers with, you know, 2-foot-long Bowie knives on their hips, and some of the people that I dealt with at Phantom were just a little bit crazy. That's all there was to it. And you kind of worried. I remember reading the book Helter Skelter years later, that the Vincent Bugliosi book about the Manson family, and I thought, man, I think some of those people were down at Phantom Ranch, you know. One of the good things that came out of the permit system is that not only did we have permits, but we reduced the number of days you could stay at any one campground. I might have mentioned this before. It had been 14 days, so I would go into Flagstaff to get groceries, and I'm driving back on Route 66, which was there at the time, and I'd see this person on the side of the road, you know, and thumbing a ride, and when I got back down to Phantom Ranch a couple days later after my days off, he's sitting in the Bright Angel campground, you know.
Huh. Okay.
So it was, and then people would stay down there for long periods of time. They would stay down there for 14 days, and then you couldn't
right.
really
right.
track it very well, and so you'd end up with these huge messes, particularly
so
when they
was that happening.
Finally left and took off.
Was that happening at Split Mountain at the campground up by the quarry where the river trips took out at the ramp there? There's a campground just downstream of there, I think. Were people staying, sort of overstaying, if you will, at Dinosaur, or was that much less?
The only place I think that took place was down at Echo Park. There was a period of time when there was a group that was staying down there for a long time, and in fact the ranger that was down there, we accused him of being, you know, part of the problem, you know. That he would, but we had one interesting case actually that involved Judge Ritter in Salt Lake City. His granddaughter went down and was staying with this one group in Echo Park, the Echo Park area, Echo Park campground, and he called the Uinta County Sheriff and said, my granddaughter's down there, and I want her back here in Salt Lake. The family was upset about it. And the Uinta County Sheriff called the Moffat County Sheriff, and the two of them went down to Echo Park, where they never told the Park Service, and they grabbed this girl. She was 17, and took her back to Salt Lake City, and because she was still a juvenile. And of course, she probably came back, and you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, when she turned 18. But that was nothing that we tracked. But that was kind of crazy to have something like that happen. The other campgrounds, Ladore, Deer Lodge, Split Mountain, were pretty much just normal Park Service campgrounds. I don't remember any issues with long term camping and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And none to speak of in the backcountry that I remember. There was a really a bizarre incident more than bizarre, that occurred, and I don't know if we've talked about this before, about Joe Alston.
No.
And, okay. You know, he'd have to fill you in on all the real details, but the story that I heard, there was a group of people, a large group, during spring break that showed up out at a place called Haystack Rock. And Haystack Rock is a big promontory along the Yampa River on the south side, where the Yampa Road comes across, and then it's a spur road that goes out. And it's a high point, and from there you can look down on the Yampa River, a pretty place. And so Steve Petersburg, who was resource management specialist and the district ranger at the time, Yampa district ranger, George Billingsley, they went out to Haystack Rock, and they ran into this real crazy group, you know, naked people running around and all kinds of, you know, problems going on out there, illegal camping being one of them. And they had a really bad time with these folks. And I don't think they wrote any tickets or anything. I think they were glad to just get out of there with their lives, you know. Apparently they were some really bad people. So later on, I think it was that winter, Joe Alston is driving across doing a patrol. He was involved in the peregrine falcon study there at Dinosaur. And
okay.
That was one of the things he was doing with the Division of Wildlife. And he ended up at Haystack Rock. He saw what he thought was a fire, and he went out to Haystack Rock, and there was a guy out there on the, like, at the viewpoint or near the viewpoint, and he was throwing burning tires off of the viewpoint and
wow.
trying to get a fire to start down below. Well, what had happened is he had murdered this woman, and I don't know if it had just occurred, but I think it had occurred previously, and then he had gone back out there with these tires trying to ignite this fire.
Yeah, you did tell this story. I remember.
Did
now.
I tell this
yeah.
story?
Yeah.
Okay. And he threw the woman had been thrown over the cliff and had landed down below. The intention was to get her into the river, and she hadn't made it to the river. And so they threw these tires over trying to ignite this fire to get rid of the evidence, which was the body down there.
Huh.
And Joe came upon this. He called the Moffat County Sheriff. They sent a deputy out, and they were able to arrest this guy and hmm. you know, of course, figure out what was going on, why are you throwing
yeah.
tires over.
Yeah.
And arrest the guy. So that was a, you know, just a really, like, bizarre.
Hey, Bob, I got a question. George Billingsley. Now, is this the same George Billingsley?
Wait a minute. Let me think. I think I've got the wrong name. George
okay.
Billingsley was down at Grand Canyon.
Yes.
Worked for the Museum Arizona.
Well, George was a boatman for a while, and he also was a
yeah.
National Park Service ranger at Supai. So So
That's right. Yeah, he did go down to Supai. I remember that now. Yeah.
did
Yeah.
Billingsley, did he actually work for Yampa for a while? Was he at Dino? Was he at Dinosaur for a while?
No,
Okay.
I've got the name wrong.
Got it. All right.
I can't remember the guy's name, but I remember his first name was
Okay.
George
All right.
Buckingham. George
Ah.
Buckingham was his name.
Got it.
Yeah, George Billingsley. I remembered him from working with the museum in Northern Arizona, and then later on, yeah, he did become a park ranger and did go down to Supai.
For a while. Okay. All right. Well, once again, we've been at this about an hour and a half, and how time flies. So
Yeah.
maybe this is a good time to wrap up this part 11, and we will pick it up again with part 12. What do you think? Sound like a
Sure.
plan? Okay.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So we'll wrap this up. This is the end of part 11, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Bob Cornelius. Today is November 9, 2017. My name is Tom Martin, and that concludes this interview. Bob, thank you so much.
You're welcome.